Judges 9. This is it's one of those chapters, difficult chapters in a difficult book. You know, I spent an extraordinary amount of time, I think, this week looking for something positive. Looking for some inkling of hope in the Israelites and in the main characters. And maybe you'll be sharper than me, but by the end of this, you're going to go, this is an awful story. There's not a good person, a bad person. It's basically everybody was bad. But as we saw last week, basically Gideon, as we looked at him over the last three chapters, two weeks, as we looked at Gideon, we saw that he was not a great man of faith. He was constantly asking the Lord for extra signs. He was a guy that walked by sight more often than faith, and yet we can't condemn him. The writer of Hebrews in Hebrews 11 lists him as being a man of faith, and certainly if we could at least strive to be as faithful as Gideon, that's an attainable goal. But we see that as his life progressed, as the Lord gave him victory over the Midianites and the Amalekites and the sons of the east, as the Lord gave him victory in that, he got kind of bitter at his countrymen for not supporting him. And then he got kind of prideful, as they said, hey, let's make you king. And then he kind of led people astray into idolatry, as he said, no, I'm not going to be your king, but if you want, you know, what I would suggest is that you make an offering. Everybody give me a gold earring from the spoil you got against the Midianites and the Amalekites and the sons of the east. And so he had quite a pile of gold, and he fashioned a golden ephod. That was that apron sort of thing that the priests would wear. He made a gold one and put it on display. We presume to say, hey, everybody, don't forget what the Lord did. This gold came from the Midianites that we conquered by the Lord's help. But really, people would look at the thing and go, oh, man, Gideon, you're the man. You are the man. You know, you should be king, you know. And it became a stumbling block to Gideon. And it became a stumbling block to the Israelites because they started worshiping this golden ephod instead of the God who had let them get that gold and get that victory. And so as Gideon's life progressed, we saw that he ended up marrying a lot of women, you know, which is not a good sign in Scripture for someone who's following after God. He ended up having 70 sons through these wives. He also had at least one concubine, and this concubine was in Shechem. And she gave birth to a son, and Gideon named her Abimelech. Now, Abimelech means, my father is king, you know. And so Gideon, while saying, no, I'm not going to be your king, later in life, named his son, my father is king. So he really seemed to stumble. And at the end there, at the end of chapter 8, we saw that Yerub-Baal, which is another name for Gideon from back when, in chapter 6, when we talked about let Baal contend with him, and this is a nickname that he picked up, Yerub-Baal. And it says that, you know, that he had, let's see. All Israel played the harlot with this ephod there, so it became a snare to Gideon and his household. Then it goes on into having all these 70 sons and things. And then the state of Israel that we find is it came about as soon as Gideon was dead in verse 33 that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals, and made Baal-Berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the household of Yerub-Baal, that is Gideon, in accord with all the good that he had done to Israel. So Gideon dies. Israel once again falls into idolatry, worshiping Baal-Berith, the Lord of the covenant, whatever god that was. And as we pick up in chapter 9, it says that Abimelech, the son of Yerub-Baal, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and spoke to them and to the whole clan of the household of his mother's father, saying, speak now in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem, which is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Yerub-Baal, rule over you, or that one man rule over you? Also remember that I am your bone and your flesh. So Gideon's son from the concubine, Abimelech, he is looking to kind of usurp the power from the 70 sons of Gideon. As a son of a concubine, he was not enjoying the rights and the authority that Gideon's sons had. Remember, by the time Gideon died, people pretty much esteemed him as a king. He was thinking, I should have taken that king job, and people pretty much gave him authority anyway. And so his 70 sons, while not altogether respected, certainly had a standing of some sort of authority, though it was not technical or though it was not legal wearing crowns and such, that people looked to them as authorities. And the son of the concubine, Abimelech, he's saying, you know, would you rather have 70 men rule over you or one? I mean, isn't that easier just to have one rather than 70? And by the way, you know, I just happen to be a relative. And so he's saying to his family, you know, maybe you could go and share this with the leadership of Shechem, our city, and maybe, just maybe, I could, you know, be your ruler. Maybe I could be the king. What do you say? And they thought that was a pretty good idea. It says that, let's see, verse 3. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem. And they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our relative. And they gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-Berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the sons of Yerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Yerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. City leaders thought this idea of Abimelech was a great idea. Yeah, we should make you king. As a matter of fact, we'll even sponsor, you know, you to rule over this. We'll even sponsor the assassination of these guys who have been ruling over us. So 70 pieces of silver for 70 lives, that sounds pretty fair. And with the money, with these 70 pieces of silver, Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows. I think the King James calls them vain and light fellows. Really, what these words mean, reckless really means reckless, but worthless literally means empty. These guys were empty and reckless. What were they empty of? Well, they weren't empty of food. They weren't empty-headed. They were empty of feeling. They were empty of conscience. They were empty of any sense of right and wrong. They were guys that, hey, man, I'll give you a piece of silver for every guy you kill. How about that? That sounds good, doesn't it? People that would actually do that. Guys with no conscience at all. Empty, void of the sense of right and wrong. Today, there's more and more people that are getting to that point. If you notice, the news is full of tragedies that happen because of guys who are empty. They're totally empty. You know, of course, the Columbine incident is still fresh in our minds, and the accounts of these two students shooting to death their classmates and laughing and inspecting the carnage and saying, look at the damage I did to this body, and oh, check this out. Completely empty of any feeling, of any conscience. How does somebody get there? They get there by sin. They get there by sin. Sin will destroy your conscience. And that's for Christians as well. The Apostle Paul told Timothy that the Holy Spirit had said explicitly that in the last days we will see by means of hypocrisy of liars seared in their own conscience as with a branding iron. How can you get empty? It's very simple. Live a life of hypocrisy. Say praise the Lord on Thursday nights and Sunday mornings, but live like the world the rest of the week. And you will become so empty because what happens is sin sears your conscience. It hardens your heart and just empties you out. Because at first, you know how it is when you're a Christian. you want to live a life of holiness, but you get tempted by some sin, or you have a problem with your flesh or whatever, and you fall into sin, and man, you feel really condemned. You feel really convicted, and you're like, oh man, I know I need to get right with God. And you get right with God, and you repent and stuff, and then that comes up again. And maybe this time, you don't get right with God in time before the next time it happens. And then again and again. And you're so tired of walking around in that condemnation and that conviction and that terrible feeling that your heart hardens against it. You begin to empty yourself of all feelings. Your conscience is being seared like a branding iron. And pretty soon, you're walking around like a robot faking it. Because sin has completely emptied you out. And yet we see it happening in the world, but we see it happening in the church as well. The road to emptiness is paved with unrepentant sin. It's paved with hypocrisy. It's paved with lies. It just calluses our consciousness until we can't feel anything at all. So, these empty guys, it was so easy to pay them to kill people. Because they were empty, because they had no conscience. These empty and reckless fellows that he said, hey, I'll give you silver to come kill these guys. And so 70 brothers, one after the other, were beheaded on this stone chopping block. One after the other after the other. What a mess. How tragic. And yet the youngest brother, Gideon's youngest son, Yotham, he hid himself. He obviously... scared, ran away, hid. He was not caught. Verse 6 says that all the men of Shechem gathered at this, and all Bayith Milo assembled together, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar which was in Shechem. Bayith Milo was this high place near Shechem. They made Abimelech their king. Says, now when they told Yotham, he went and stood at the top of Mount Gerizim and lifted his voice and called out. Thus he said to them, listen to me, O men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. Once the trees went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, reign over us, but the olive tree said to them, shall I leave my fatness with which God and men are honored and go to wave over the trees? So then the tree said to the fig tree, you come reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go to wave over the trees? Then the trees said to the vine, you come reign over us. But the vine said to them, shall I leave my new wine which cheers God and men and go to wave over the trees? Finally, all the trees said to the bramble, you, come, reign over us. While they're celebrating their victory, the men of Shechem anointing Abimelech king, Yotham gets to the top of Mount Gerizim, and he shouts down to these people. He's actually in a safe place. It would, from where they were at Bayith Milo, it would take them about 20 minutes to get up to where he was. Certainly time to get away. And so from there, from that safety, he shouts down to them this story. And he says, listen to me. I'm going to tell you a story about some trees. And the trees, looking for a leader, looking for someone to reign over them, asked fruit-bearing plants. The olive tree, the fig tree, the vine, people that were bearing fruit, said, hey, rule over us. And they said, well, we're busy bearing fruit. We're being productive here. If we just go and wave over you, that's kind of pointless. And so in desperation, they turn to the bramble. The bramble is basically, it's a shrub which is full of spines. It's a tangled mass of vegetation. It has some really pretty flowers, but it's no good for anything. It's not big enough or thick enough to offer any shade. Its wood is too brittle and too small to use for any kind of construction. It bears no fruit at all. It's just, it's a weed. And actually, it's dangerous to the flocks shepherds are even in Israel to this day. The bramble is a kind of a nightmare sort of thing, because the sheep, if they get into it, you know, get all tangled up. It's a mess. Basically, the only thing that the bramble is good for is for starting fires. That's all it is. You tear it up out of the ground, you let it dry out. It basically turns into a tumbleweed, and you can start fires with it. That's all it's good for. Now, obviously, Yotham is telling this story, saying, you guys are a bunch of trees and you're looking for someone to reign over you. And first of all, you ask Gideon, and he was too busy, you know, and saying, no, I'm being productive for God here. I'm not going to reign over you. And so then you turn to his brothers, and his brothers were too busy bearing fruit, and they weren't going to be your king. And so you turn to the bramble, to Abimelech. You know what? And all he's good for is starting fires. And we're going to see that literally that's what's going to happen. By the end of the chapter, we're going to see that that's all he's good for is starting fires. And so, verse 15, he continues his story. And the bramble said to the trees, if in truth you are anointing me as king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. Not much shade from a bramble. Come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon. Yotham's story is basically hinting at a distrust that's already there, that's already underlying. The bramble's response to the trees when the tree said, reign over us, the bramble's response was, if you're really asking me to be king, then okay, that's great. But if not, you know, there's this distrust there. There's some underlying treachery that might be going on here. And so we're going to discover again that there's an underlying tension that's going to lead to outward aggression in just 3 years between these trees and this bramble, or the men of Shechem and Abimelech. Verse 16, he continues shouting down from Mount Gerizim, saying, now, therefore, if you have dealt in truth and integrity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Yerubbaal and his house, and have dealt with him as he deserved, for, as he puts in parentheses now, by the way, for my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian, but you have risen against my father's house today and have killed his sons, 70 men on one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of his maidservant, king over the men of Shechem, because he is your relative, end parenthesis, if then you have dealt in truth and integrity with Yerubbaal and his house this day, rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem and Baith-Milo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from Baith-Milo and consume Abimelech. Then Yotham escaped and fled and went to Be'er and remained there because of Abimelech, his brother. It's hard to imagine that this guy was actually, Abimelech was actually the brother, or at least the half-brother, of these 70 guys that he killed, and this one more guy that he'd like to kill. I think he was just as empty and void of conscience as the guys he hired. Yotham is saying, he's pronouncing this curse. He's saying, hey, if you've dealt in truth and integrity, and if what you've done is right, hey, God bless you guys. You just work it out great. But if not, if you've been treacherous, if that's what's going on, and which is obvious what is happening, then I'm speaking a curse over you. May you destroy each other. And we will see that is exactly what happened. So he's up there on Mount Gerizim before they can come after him. He runs to Be'er and hides. Verse 22, now Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years. Then God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. And the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech in order that the violence done to the 70 sons of Yerubbaal might come, and their blood might be laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. After 3 years, division breaks out. Treachery breaks out between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. God did this. He accomplished this by sending what the writer says is an evil spirit. An evil spirit, an interesting study. You don't actually find evil spirits too much in the Old Testament. In this, the words are ra, ruach. Now, ra means bad or evil. Ruach, you might know, that's the Hebrew word for the Holy Spirit as well. It means spirit or breath or wind. And so, the ra, ruach, you can actually be justified in translating that bad breath. That, you know, God gave them all bad breath and they didn't like each other. that you wouldn't be justified in interpreting it that way, but you could certainly translate it that way. In reality, the Lord is sending a spirit of distrust and treachery between them to cause division between them. And so the obvious question as you go through the Old Testament with us, remember we saw... Well, actually, in the New Testament also, 2 Timothy, when Paul referred to the spirit of timidity, or some people refer to it the spirit of fear. That was the spirit inside Timothy. It was the man's spirit. And back in Numbers chapter 5, we talked about a spirit of jealousy coming over a man. These were not like demonic unclean spirits like Jesus was casting out of the men and women who were demonized. They were the spirit of the man. Now, obviously, there are demonic spirits as well that inhabit a person and live in a person and traumatize a person and afflict a person. We refer to those as unclean spirits or maybe evil spirits. Did God send a heart of division, or did God actually send a spiritual entity, a demon, to cause this? There's no way of knowing. Either way is right. God can do what he wants. Either way, you can read it into the text. It's not important to the story, but it is important to be able to discern these things, to know that sometimes when you're reading in the Bible, for example, the spirit of jealousy, we don't go binding the spirit of jealousy like he's some demon that's afflicting somebody. The spirit of jealousy is, man, I'm jealous. I think my wife's cheating on me, and I've got a spirit of jealousy. You know, it's a man's spirit, but then there are unclean spirits as well, the actually demonic entities. So, again, like I said, it doesn't affect the story. Basically, the fruit of it was that God put division between Abimelech and the men of Shechem and treachery and caused problems here. Why did the Lord send this spirit? Because these guys, the king and the men of Shechem, had killed Gideon's sons. And the Bible tells us, do not be deceived, in Galatians chapter 6. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. A man reaps what he sows. And so they did this thinking, oh, God doesn't see. God doesn't hear. But he did see, and he did hear, and he made sure. See, a lot of us think that sins are gotten away with when they're not immediately punished. You know, if we run the red light and a cop doesn't see us, man, we're off scot-free, aren't we? We're done. But sin doesn't work that way. I'm not saying that running a red light is not a sin, but, you know, sin, every analogy breaks down sooner or later, sometimes sooner than later. Sin doesn't always have repercussions immediately. You think you got away with it. Nobody caught you. Nobody saw you. But God caught you, and God saw you. And he is saying that when you do things like this, you are sowing seeds. Seeds don't, it's not always like Jack and the Beanstalk. Even Jack and the Beanstalk, it took the night to grow into a vine. But some seeds you plant and you don't see anything from them for a while. But after a while, it begins to grow up. And suddenly, there it is. Suddenly it's time to reap what you've sown. And so, even though it took 3 years, this is coming back to them. That just as they had been treacherous and deceitful to Gideon's sons, now they're being treacherous and deceitful to one another, and it's coming back on them. A man reaps what he sows. God is not mocked. And this crop is growing up to haunt them. In verse 25, the men of Shechem set men in ambush against him on the tops of the mountains, and they robbed all who might pass by them along the road, and it was told to Abimelech. So they're figuring, well, Abimelech comes and goes, so what we'll do is we'll just plant a bunch of ambushes in the main roads there, and we'll just keep ambushing people until we catch him, and then we'll kill him. And, well, we're not going to ambush people for no reason. Let's just rob them, you know. So they were robbing all these people, and, of course, he found out about it. Verse 26, now Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his relatives and crossed over into Shechem. And the men of Shechem put their trust in him. This guy, he shows up in town during this mess, and Gaal. And he's obviously a very likable guy, a very charismatic guy, probably a good-looking guy, probably a good speaker, somebody that people just naturally are attracted to follow. You know, we call them born leaders, or somebody who's just, man, he's just a likable guy. And so immediately the men of the city, you know, they don't like their king. They don't like Abimelech. And they're going, Gaal, you know, he's a pretty good guy. I trust him. It seems like he would make a better king than Abimelech, you know. And so they put him into some kind of authority. He's not the ruler of the city. He's not the king yet. But they're following him. And they're hoping that someday he will obviously be the authority. We need to be careful, because it's so we're going to see this guy is not who he, not all he's cracked up to be, not all he's claiming to be, maybe you might say. It's really easy for people to walk in the door of the club or the door of the church or to come into an organization and you're going, man, this guy's a born leader. He's great. You know, it doesn't matter. He's only been to one meeting. Let's elect him the president, you know. It's like, yeah, there's a guy. He's been coming to the church for a good couple of weeks now, and I think he'd make a great elder. Let's go ahead and make him leadership. You know what? As a matter of fact, I'll make him my assistant pastor. You know, that's a recipe for disaster. That is just, that never is going to go, it's never going to go well. 1 Timothy 5, Paul warned Timothy because, you know, we're all susceptible to this. Because it takes so long for us to learn what a person's character really is that it was easy for Timothy to look and see some guy, well, this guy seems really mature in the Lord. This guy seems like... But Paul said, don't lay hands on anyone, like laying hands like that, imparting of authority. Don't lay hands on anyone too hastily, and thus share responsibility for the sins of others. Keep yourself free from sin. Basically, what he was saying was, you know, when you appoint an elder in the church and you lay hands on him, you're imparting your authority, some of your authority to him, just as Moses did to Joshua. And if that guy falls into sin, man, you're accountable because you're the shepherd of this church, or you're the under-shepherd of this church. You're accountable for that. And he's going, don't do it too hastily. It's too easy for us to jump to conclusions and go, hey, that guy's a great, that guy would make great. And even as I've been talking to a number of guys about deaconing and sharing with each one of them, 1 Timothy 3:10 saying, let these also first be tested, then let them serve as deacons if they are beyond reproach. Again, somebody walks in, you know, walks in the door after they've been with the church 2 weeks, you know, and we see him helping out, you know, hey, let's make this guy a deacon. Wait a second. This guy's got to be tested first. This guy's character has to be examined. His walk with God has to be proven. And so let them first be tested. But you know, we can all fake it for a while, and Gaal was doing a pretty good job, and so they, the men of Shechem quickly put their trust in him. And what we see, verse 27, that they went out into the field. This guy's obviously a partier too. They went out in the field and gathered the grapes of the vineyards and trod them and held a festival, and they went into the house of their god and ate and drank and cursed Abimelech. Then Gaal, the son of Ebed, who said, who is Abimelech, who and who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Yerubbaal? And is Zebul not his lieutenant? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, but why should we serve him? Would therefore that this people were under my authority, then I would remove Abimelech. And he said to Abimelech, increase your army and come out. Now, obviously, Abimelech is not there. They've been drinking. He's like, oh, Abimelech, come on out. I'll take you on. The more they drank, the more they cursed their leader. There's probably a side tangent that we could take off talking about drinking and how you say things you normally wouldn't say when you're drinking. We could talk about cursing your leaders and rather than praying for them, but basically the situation is here. They're all drinking in the temple. They're getting drunk. They're cursing him and saying, "Oh, I could take him on. Oh, if I was your king, man, I'd take care of it." He also rails on the leader of the city. Remember, Abimelech was king over the region, but he had a lieutenant Zebul, who was the official leader, the lieutenant, the official ruler of the city of Shechem. And he's going on about him too. And when Zebul, verse 30, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal. Boy, he had some gall, didn't he? Oh, sorry. When Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, his anger burned, and he sent messengers to Abimelech deceitfully, saying, "Behold, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his relatives have come to Shechem, and behold, they are stirring up the city against you. Now, therefore, arise by night, you and the people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. And it shall come about in the morning, as soon as the sun is up, that you shall rise early and rush upon the city. And behold, when he and the people who are with you, or with him, come out against you, you shall do to them whatever you can." So Abimelech and all the people who were with him arose by night and lay in wait against Shechem in four companies. So obviously Zebul wasn't thrilled with what Gaal had been saying about his leader and about himself, and he's going, hey, he sends a message to Abimelech saying, hey, the city's kind of in an uproar here. You're getting a lot less popular, and there's somebody who looks like they might be taking over a leadership position here. You probably should come and nip this in the bud. And so Abimelech gets four companies of guys and comes or sneaks there at night, and we see verse 35. Now Gaal the son of Ebed went out and stood in the entrance of the city gate. This, as you recall, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, you see examples of business being done in the city gate, the city's elders gathering at the city gate, courts and things being heard, judges judging at the city gate. The city gate was like this happening place where everybody who was anybody was kind of gathered together there. And so typically the elders, the leaders, the judges of the city would gather together there. So of course, Gaal, you know, he's there. You know, he's nobody yet, but he's certainly got a following. So maybe I'll just hang out here by the city gate and poke my nose in. And he's standing next to Zebul here. And it says they were stood there in the entrance of the city gate. And Abimelech and the people who were with him arose from the ambush. And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, "Look, people are coming down from the tops of the mountains." But Zebul said to him, "No, you are seeing the shadow of the mountains as if they were men." So he tried to stall, you know. "Oh, no, that's just the shifting shadows. It's just the sun. You know, it's the trees. Yeah, I don't want to eat. That happens every morning, you know." And Gaal spoke again and said, "Behold, people are coming down from the highest part of the land, and one company comes by the way of the diviner's oak." Then Zebul said to him, "Where's your boasting now? Where's your boasting now with which you said, 'Who is Abimelech that we should serve him? Is this not the people whom you despised? Go out now and fight them.'" So he's not tipping his hand saying, "I'm the one who told," but he's saying, "Hey, I just heard you the other night," saying, "Oh man, I could take him," you know. So he's going, "Okay, hot shot, go for it. You know, here's your chance. Let's see what you got." And verse 39, so Gaal went out before the leaders of Shechem and fought with Abimelech. If you've read ahead, you know this how this is going to turn out. How do you think it's going to turn out? And Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him, and many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. He didn't do so good. He talked. He talked his talk. "Oh, yeah, increase your army. Come on out," you know. It didn't happen. Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him, and many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. Then Abimelech remained at Arumah, but Zebul drove out Gaal and his relatives so that they could not remain in Shechem. Abimelech goes on home to Arumah. Arumah is an interesting place. You might think of it as Elvis's Graceland, or, you know, basically it's, you know, it's his home. It's a big palatial kind of thing. He names it something. Well, he named it Arumah, which means "I shall be exalted." So we're seeing Abimelech, a more sensitive side, more humble side of him, maybe. "I shall be exalted." Yeah, great name for a humble man's abode. Verse 42, it came about the next day. Now, okay, it's all done. Gaal and his followers are gone. You'd think everything's back to normal, right? But it came about the next day that the people went out to the field, and it was told to Abimelech. So he took his people and divided them into three companies and lay in wait in the field. When he looked and saw the people coming out from the city, he arose against them and slew them. Then Abimelech and the company who was with him dashed forward and stood in the entrance of the city gate. The other two companies then dashed against all who were in the field and slew them. And Abimelech fought against the city all that day, and he captured the city and killed the people who were in it. Then he razed the city and sowed it with salt. The people of Shechem figured, since Gaal's gone, everything's going to be back to normal, but it wasn't. Abimelech was mad, and he wanted to wipe everybody out. And he did. That's exactly what he did. He came and took the place. He actually used one of his companies to block the gate so they couldn't run into the city and be protected. Killed all the workers who were in the field, then went in and killed everybody else. Then leveled the place and then sowed it with salt. Now, if you've ever seen the great salt, you know what I'm talking about. Y'all know where I'm at. Salty things, nothing grows. Salt destroys vegetation and it keeps it from growing back. And so basically what he's doing is he's saying nobody's ever going to live here again. Nobody's ever going to grow here again. Nobody's ever going to prosper here again. Salt destroys those things. It you know, basically wipes the thing out. There's a couple of interesting verses. Psalm 107:33. The psalmist saying, he speaking to the Lord, he changes rivers into a wilderness and springs of water into a thirsty ground, a fruitful land into a salt waste because of the wickedness of those who dwell in it. Interesting, a salt waste. And the prophet Jeremiah wrote, he will be like a bush in the desert and will not see when prosperity comes, but will live in stony wastes in the wilderness, a land of salt without inhabitant. So salt is a good thing to have on the dinner table. But salt's not a good thing to have in the ground because it messes everything up. And it's Abimelech's intention was to turn the city of Shechem into a wasteland that nobody would ever inhabit again in repayment for their treachery. Verse 46, when all the leaders of the tower of Shechem heard of it, they entered the inner chamber of the temple of El-Berith. It's another name for Baal-Berith, the Lord of the Covenant or God of the Covenant. And it was told Abimelech that all the leaders of the tower of Shechem were gathered together. So Abimelech went to Mount Salmon, he and all the people who were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a branch from the trees and lifted it and laid it on his shoulder. Then he said to the people who were with him, "What you have seen me do, hurry and do likewise." And all the people also cut down each one his branch and followed Abimelech and put them on the inner chamber and set the inner chamber on fire over those inside, so that all the men of the tower of Shechem also died, about 1,000 men and women. This tower was part of the temple of this false god over on a hill near Shechem called Salmon. When Abimelech found out that they were there, he's like, "Man, grab a branch, let's go." And he set the place on fire, killed them all. He was the bramble of Yotham's story. And Yotham had said, "Man, if this was treachery, if this was not done in honesty and integrity, let Abimelech fire come out from him and burn you guys up." And that's exactly what happened. Verse 50 says that then Abimelech went to Tebates, and he camped against Tebates and captured it. But there was a strong tower in the center of the city, and all the men and women with all the leaders of the city fled there and shut themselves in, and they went up on the roof of the tower. Now you figure he's already got how to take care of towers, right? We know how to deal with people in towers. So Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it and approached the entrance of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head, crushing his skull. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest it be said of me, a woman slew him." So the young man pierced him through and he died. Pride to the very end. I will be exalted. Let me rule over you. After all, I'm your flesh and blood. This guy's life was a waste from beginning to end. I mean, there's not a single positive thing you can find about this guy. He was vengeful. He was deceitful. He was wicked. He was a murderer. There's not a single good thing you can say about this guy. And that's hard. Sometimes you can find somebody, well, he's got nice hair. You know, I mean, you can't find a single good thing to say about this guy. And finally, at the end, even in pride, going, oh, kill me, you know, so my legacy won't be that I was killed by a woman. Well, you know, I think we need to be concerned less about the last minute of our life and more about all the minutes that came before that. We need to be concerned with how our lives are led. We need to be concerned about the years, not the last few minutes. A lot of people's last few minutes are ugly. But we need to be concerned about the years that we spend before those last few minutes. But his armor bearer runs him through, kills him. Verse 55, and when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, each departed to his home. Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father in killing his 70 brothers. Also God returned all the wickedness of the men of Shechem on their heads, and the curse of Jotham, the son of Yerubbaal, came upon them. Like I said at the beginning, this chapter of Judges seems to have no positive instruction. But we can certainly learn from mistakes. The Apostle Paul said a number of times that these things were written for our instruction, that we might learn from them. And we don't always have to follow the positive examples. A lot of times we can look at these negative examples and go, man, I don't want to be anything like that. And I think that's one of these chapters about the only thing Abimelech is famous for. I mean, if you asked a kid in the church if they knew anything about this story, they might say, yeah, I remember a Sunday school story once where a millstone got pushed off a tower and onto somebody's head. That's about it. That's his lasting legacy. He was the guy that got smushed by the millstone. But I think that probably more than anything else is just following, or avoiding, I should say, not following, avoiding the negative examples and understanding that even Christians reap what they sow. A lot of times God is merciful, but there is spiritual laws at work that we plant these seeds and we need to expect to see them grow. So let's stop planting them. And so being reminded that we will someday reap what we have sown, let's go to the Lord and ask Him to uproot all those plants.